The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the August 26, 2013 edition of The Heretic's Hour, streaming to you live from the White Network. If it's the end of August, you know it's going to be one of our special quarterly programs where our White Network staff comes together to exchange views on topics we really want to talk about together. So I welcome our staff, along with myself, Tan Stoffel, and Hadding Scott to tonight's show. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Well, you both say hello at the same time, so I guess that was both of you. Well, I'm glad to have you here. I'm really always look forward to this, and I'm looking forward to it tonight very much because I like what we're going to be talking about. And to start out, well, we've got Bobby Jindal's article, interview or something, what you'd call it, essay. Martin Luther King on the menu. Leo Frank, and besides the question of a white folk, but I thought to start out, though, I want to, since we're all here, I want to take this opportunity to thank those who send financial support to the White Network, and in the form of money. And we get this mostly through PayPal, but also by check to our post office box, and all that information is available on the website under Donate. I know a lot of people probably just get our podcasts through these services, just comes into their system, and they don't ever look at our website, maybe, but there's a lot on our website that's of interest. We even have some blogs, you know, that once in a while we put up a blog, and that you wouldn't be hearing that as a podcast. So if you want to take a look at that once in a while, and you'll find that information about donating. And I've already thanked some of the contributors by name in early August, but since August 6th, we received a donation from Victor, from Marty, from Thomas, and from an anonymous donor. So we thank you all very much for that. Right?
Yes, thank you. This way we don't have to argue with each other about who's going to foot the bill.
That's right. And, you know, I want to say, you know, we do receive enough to pay all our bills. So that we have. So that's very nice. And we were just talking about a new bill that's probably going to come up here before the show started. And so it's nice to know that we will have enough to cover that. So thank you all very much. Well, I thought that we could just start out with this Bobby Jindal political news or essay that he wrote on Politico that you pointed out to me, I think, just this morning, Tan.
Yeah. Well, the context for it is this 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It's coming up on the 28th. Mm-hmm. And so that's the backdrop that Jindal was writing to.
Yeah, that's right. And he said some things in here. You said you wanted to talk about it. I'd like to say some things about it, too, but I'll let you start.
Well, my first reaction in hearing that it's been 50 years since MLK said this I Have a Dream speech, and that everybody quotes, and that he's such a saint today, and as we saw in the Trayvon thing, that he's the one that they wanted to compare Trayvon to as a saint, is I have a nightmare. And, you know, I have a dream that I wake up and the nightmare ends. And I think my nightmare is what most white people in America are experiencing and have been experiencing since even before Martin Luther King came to fame with that speech. The country is no longer our country. It's no longer a white country, and that's nothing new. What most white people are starting to realize slowly but surely over the decades as it goes on is what that means, that not having a country that's yours, that looks out for your interests, even as part of a group. I don't expect my country to look out for me personally, but I do expect my country to give me something to hope and dream for. Give me something positive. Don't treat me like a criminal. Just you know, because of the color of my skin, to put it in the trite terms that that these guys put it in. And we could talk a little bit about that as we get into what Jindal actually had to say about it, just how trite it is that the political discourse today, where we've come in those 50 years, this pretense that race is color of skin is something I've talked about in a few of my podcast installments, and we could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think what you just said really hits home. I want to emphasize this. That the idea that you said white people are starting to realize that we're not a white country anymore, and what that means, because I don't think this is what waking up is, I guess. You know, I don't think people have understood what that means. We've been so caught up, and when I say we, I guess I include myself up to a point, but you know, I'm just speaking in the generals, the white people of this country. We've been so caught up in the idea of all these good things we're doing for all these non-whites, you know, and how to be liberal and how to be open-minded and how not to be against anybody and how to accept things and all of this, and not really looking why, you know, this would be part of our question of who's at fault here. Why don't we look past what we're doing in today and say, hey, wait a minute, down the line, you know, this is not going to be my country, and it's not going to be, it maybe won't be looking out for me, and where will I go to have any place that looks out after me? And the answer is nowhere. And it's just like this will come as a huge shock to people, but after it becomes a reality, probably.
Well, a lot of them think that the whole idea of white people having a country that's looking out for white interests is racist, and racist is something that they should avoid. And
Yeah. What
they really think it is going towards some sort of equal society where everyone is treated equally. That's what the rhetoric of Bobby Jindal is, and that's what the rhetoric for the last 50 years has been. But that's a total fraud. That's what white people wake up to when they finally wake up, is that they realize this isn't about equality, which sounds very good, but it's on the surface, but when you realize it's actually a society that teaches everyone, including whites, that whites are the bad guys, that they are the historic, eternal oppressors of everybody. And since being the bad guys, we're entitled to be treated badly by everybody else. That's the narrative of
society. Well, do you think
society.
That's just coming out now?
It's been there all along. It's just been increasingly obvious as it goes on.
Yeah.
You know, in the war, when I analyzed some of the propaganda that was generated by the Boasian anthropologists during World War II, that Brotherhood of Man and the Races of Mankind pamphlet that came out during the war and was given to our troops, you see some of the same stuff that they're still saying today, you know, that diversity is a strength, and you get all this ethnic food from all over the world, and it's unavoidable. We just have to do it because it's going to happen. And race is just skin color and a few other little minor details. But what you see clearly is that they were afraid to say that white people are the bad guys, and only stupid, crazy, evil white people think that race is important. In fact, what their propaganda said was that it implicitly acknowledged the reality of race. What it did was it said, but it isn't really all that important. It doesn't make that much of a difference. Yeah, people are different and they've got all these different traits and everything, but it's not anything important. Under the skin, we're all the same, which is a fraud. We know in the science that was being done at the time and has been done since, that race runs a lot deeper than just skin color, and more deeper than anything visible.
Well, sure. Now, the first sentence, now, of course, Bobby Jindal, for those who might not be sure, is governor of Louisiana. And he is a pretty dark-skinned, I'm hearing an echo of myself here, coming back, a little better one. He's a pretty dark-skinned Indian, although he was born here. His parents emigrated here from India, and they went to Louisiana, of all places. And he's become governor, and he's fairly popular. And he came on as he's a Republican, isn't he? And he came on as pretty moderate, you know, nice guy, and all this stuff. It was about clean government, because there's always been a lot of corruption in Louisiana, I think. And so he was, you know, a clean politician and so on. And the people went for him, and I think he might maybe still is popular. But he's on this race thing now, and the first thing that he said that I thought was pretty untrue was the media appetite for all things race-related is unquenchable. Now, that's just his introduction, you know. But I would say the media appetite for things race-related is they actually don't want to talk about it unless they talk about it in a certain way. What would you two say about that?
Well, it's true that the race is in the news every single day, and they hype it in certain ways, certainly not in any way that's positive for whites. There has been a development recently since the Trayvon thing. There's been a couple of new news stories where whites have been the victims of blacks, and that is starting to break through now in from Jewish conservative media. But it's painted as a black and white issue, and it's a little bit separate than Jindal's issue here. Is he wants to go beyond? He wants to step beyond race. He wants to just pretend like it's skin color, and it's crazy that we're so tied up about. He wants to deny that race is significant. He starts by saying how significant it is, noticing that the media has stories about it every day. But then he claims that he doesn't understand why, because it's just about skin color. And then he concludes by saying that we should put it aside. But here's a guy who married an Indian woman, and it was in 1997. It's not like he married her a long time ago or before he came to America. When he was looking around for a mate to choose, he chose someone like himself to marry. That's how natural it is. And he's saying race isn't important and who we are isn't important, but part of the kick, if not his, he alludes to it himself, is his identity as an Indian American, as an Indian. That is what gives him, at least partly, what gives him authority to even speak on this subject. That he came here, and this is what I'm different from your usual idea of an American, and this is my view on it, and I have authority on it. It's just like what the Jews say, you know, as a Jew, I think this or that about how you should think or you should act. That's what he's doing.
Did you want to say something, Hanny?
Well, I was looking at the Encyclopedia Britannica. Jindal is from a caste called the Baniya. I guess that's how you pronounce it. Baniya caste. And Encyclopedia Britannica says that this caste consists generally of money lenders or merchants, found chiefly in northern and western India. Yeah.
Crypto Jews?
Well, probably not, but there's a kind of a similar pattern that can develop. It's economic man, we can say. But the merchants are the third of the four castes. The top caste is the Brahmins, and then the Kshatriyas, which are the warrior caste. And then after that, you have the merchant caste. So he's from a relatively low caste. And so being from a relatively low position in Indian society, perhaps he doesn't like that kind of social ordering.
Yeah, but the merchants in India are now probably pretty wealthy and aren't really considered of a lower caste maybe than what would the warriors be, people in the military? What I think is interesting about that is that so many of these people they function just the same way Jews do. They're looking out for their own interests, and they talk about this and that kind of a thing the same way, just in this, you know, exactly the same.
Yeah, Indians are very, my experience, Indians are they're kind of ruthless, we'll put it that way. they don't have any pity for anybody.
Is that the Hindu thing? Is that have anything to do with which religion they are? Because I hear a lot of their enemies of the Indians, or even Indians who are not Hindus, talk about how bad they are and how
the Pakistanis don't like them.
Yeah, that's for sure. But they're,
anyway,
they're
different from us. I remember after Obama got elected, some of these Republican radio talking heads were all excited about Laura Ingraham was one. One wanted to have Bobby Jindal run for president. Well, the Democrats got their non-white guy. We need to get one, too. That's basically their attitude. It's so stupid.
Well, yeah. And here's the way something that shows how they just think the opposite of what we think is the sentence here right in the beginning, too. Racism is one of the more tragic features of the human condition. Like greed, yeah. Envy, and other sins, blah, blah. It's been around for thousands of years. And, you know, well, I think racism is a good thing. Yeah. And there's nothing. It's just, it's the natural order of things. It's nature. But yet they want to, you know, portray it as tragic and sinful.
Yeah, let me read another sentence, too, that caught my eye. There is no more shallow, hollow, or soulless way to think about human beings than in terms of their skin color. It is completely inane. Under what logic would any intelligent, logical, or decent person give any thought to the pigmentation of a person's epidermis? It's nothing short of immoral, not to mention stupid. Oops, there's that word again.
Yeah.
Is the level of our political discourse, yeah. This kind yeah. of
yeah, retardation. I had that marked out, too. And I just want to emphasize there that he used the word, you know, a decent person wouldn't care about skin color, and it's immoral. It's yes. stupid. I mean, this kind of language is really inflammatory.
It's a very sneaky way of saying that if you don't agree with him, if you think that race is important and mm-hmm. natural and all the rest, then you're stupid, crazy, or evil. Yeah. It's a very sneaky, indirect way of making that statement without yeah. saying it directly.
Yeah. So says the resentful brown-skinned low caste guy.
Yeah,
Exactly. He's got this dark skin. He wants to be an American. He wants to be, you know, just like anybody else here. So he has to attack any reference to skin color that anybody should think that dark skin is not as good as light skin. It's all in his own interest. And then he's a politician. He comes here. Why? If he comes here to be an American, why does he choose to become a politician? I say because he wants to change this country. He wants to change our laws to make it more favorable to people like himself.
Oh, it's probably not that calculating. He probably just wants to have the gold star on his curriculum vitae. You know.
Well, I don't know what makes
probably
people...
just personal. Ambition, really.
There was another interesting part that we haven't mentioned yet, and that was the paragraph where he talks about how when I look at America, I see a country that increasingly has lost its way in terms of morality. As a Christian, I look at American culture over the past half century. I don't like a lot of what I see. He talks about divorce and pornography, sexual predators, the abortion rate. And then he talks about vulgarity and profanity are mainstream and commonplace, and in general, our culture has become coarser. Now, the thing about that that's obvious to all of us is that's the Jewish influence. That's because the Jews run this country, and they run the media specifically, which pumps out this crap. But he would never say that. He would
Jewish influence and also the parading of Negro entertainment in our faces, that's big part of it, Negro music and so forth.
But he brings this stuff up.
By Jews.
But he doesn't say who's responsible. He just leaves the idea that it's Americans. You know, it's a failure of America, failure of Americans, that our morality has gone so far down. But
well,
then he says, but after he said all that, go ahead, Dan.
This is what makes him a Republican. This is what makes Republicans think that he's speaking to them and their values. This is social conservatism. This, you know, objection to abortion and profanity and pornography and all of that. This is what appeals to the old stock conservative Americans, rural America.
But then after saying all these bad things, how bad the morality is in this country and divorce and abortion and sex and so on and so forth. However, he says, in terms of racism, we have come a long way, as though we're doing well because we've made all this progress. since Dr. King gave his speech. Well, that's just politicking, I guess.
It's the opposite. The truth, as he can see, as he's the picture he paints himself, is that things have gotten worse in the last 50 years. The society has gotten coarser.
There you go. There you go. So we haven't made progress since Dr. King's speech and since everything that happened from it, since the Civil Rights Act, things have gone to hell.
Well, I suppose if you believe everything that you see on TV, you might think that. You might think that the corrupt Southern police in Sanford, Florida are helping a murderer of poor innocent black child go free. And, you know, you can believe all kinds of crazy stuff if you take TV as your witness.
Well, but even if you don't, I mean, you look around, you can see what's, I don't know what, people who watch TV regularly and who believe it, then they go on and on, particularly if they're Christians or whatever, how bad everything is. It's just terrible in this country, terrible what's going on, you know, but then they don't blame the right person or people or things for it. How could this be happening? How did this happen? How did it get like this? You know, they have no answers because the television doesn't allow them to get to the right answer. Think?
Yeah, well, the television is propaganda, and it's anti-white propaganda, and there's nothing positive on television for us. Even the stuff that appeals to white people instinctively is just a little bit of sugar coating around a payload of poison.
But then he ends up blaming hyphenated Americans for the whole problem. Oh, seems to me, you know, yeah. Doesn't he? I mean, he ends
as
up with that.
He's completely shed his Indian identity.
Well, exactly.
Yeah,
that was
right.
My point about him finding an Indian wife to marry. And he doesn't mention the Jews. Now, he's got to be well aware of the Jews being a politician, a national politician. And so if you're taught, he lists out a bunch of different hyphenated Americans, Asians and Italians and Africans and Mexicans, Cubans and Indians. But he doesn't mention the Jews. And the Jews, as whatever their numbers are, you've got to admit that they're the most powerful of all of these hyphenated Americans when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to the media, finance, academia.
Well, you know what? When hyphenated Americans are talked about, they never talk about it. They never mention the Jews. And, of course, he doesn't. I mean, just goes to show he knows better than to do that. Well, what else is he
saying? It's good to contrast this with Biden's recent speech where he praised Jews openly for their influence through their media for all of the things that Bobby Jindal condemns. The homosexual marriage and so forth that Biden credits the Jews with pushing and getting with their control over the media that Jindal doesn't mention.
Well, that's right. And then he also goes on about we don't want he says we need to get our melting pot back, you know, talking about those hyphenated Americans.
Jesus.
We don't want a salad bowl. We want the melting pot. And then he says, I try to treat people as individuals. Now, isn't this a contradiction to the melting pot? He wants everybody to melt together, but yet we're all going to be treated as individuals.
No, that's consistent because that's what liberalism is. If you judge people strictly as individuals, then you don't think about groups, right? That's strict liberalism in the proper 19th century meaning of the word, right? Judging people as individuals, everybody just living as an individual, not as a member of an interest group. It's completely unrealistic, but that's sort of the official ideology of the United States, especially the Republican Party.
Yeah, the difference being that in the 19th century, that liberalism still had a concept of nationalism and still had the concept of race that was compatible. We didn't pretend that everybody was exactly equal. We just had this idea of civic nationalism that, you know, once you're part of our nation, we treat you equally under the law. Mm-hmm. But this is part of the fraud. It was the camel's nose in the tent that got white people going down this path of opening our societies And you can trace it back even farther than the 19th century, a couple hundred years before that, the emancipation of the Jews, when the Jews were the only real minority living amongst Europeans in their societies. And once they ironed that out, that the Jews, it was okay for the Jews to stick around in Germany because they were just as good as any German, that was the beginning of the end. Even though at that time, people still thought so strongly about their nationalism that Germany and France and Britain and Italy and all warred with each other brutally over what seems senseless in retrospect today.
Okay.
That too, I would attribute to Jewish influence, that the Jews were not passive in all of this, sitting back and watching Europeans beat themselves up, and now they've swooped in, taken control. They were actively pushing liberalism all along the way.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And then, you know, he ends up with this utopianism. That's what I call it. You know, we're all going to fit together. Nobody's going to care about the color of anybody's skin. Or eyes or hair, for that matter, well, he throws those in because it's more than skin. And whether you're skinny, tall, fat, short, dark, light, whatever, you know. And so we're all going to be so happy. Except that, you know, he says it's time for the end of race in America. That was his title, yeah. The end of race.
Yeah, so, good luck, you know, on that.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that's not possible. It's totally utopian. It just doesn't fit.
Dude, when they're going out of their way to attack white people on television, that's not going to be the end of white identity. You know, they made George Zimmerman into an honorary white man just so they could attack him as a white man. You know, this is not the way to make people think less about race. Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck are talking more about racial concerns lately.
Yeah, well, you know, there's people who say, why should we pay attention to Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck? But they
Those guys are very influential, especially Limbaugh. Limbaugh actually...
Well, they are that. True.
Recently, Limbaugh has been copying some things from Beck. But Limbaugh, I was listening to him today. He was talking Obama. He was quoting Obama. I think he played a soundbite from Obama, even maybe. But Obama has said recently that he tries to have conferences with Republican legislators to convince them to support some issue that he wants to put through. And these Republican legislators tell him they can't do it because they're afraid of what Rush Limbaugh will say.
And the Tea Party, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I believe it, you know, because Rush Limbaugh has a kind of a bully pulpit. He's kind of the priest of Republicanism on the radio. And a lot of people listen to him. A lot of people listen to him, and they take to heart what he says.
Well, he's supposed to be the most listened to. He's the most listened to radio person ever in the history of the world.
Put him as the most hated Republican.
Yeah, I don't know what poll. So what about his listeners? They're not in that poll or something? He's supposed to have millions of them. All these polls.
Well, he appeals to whites, white conservatives, millions of them. But he's... You know, I used to think I used to think positively about figures like him, Glenn Beck, even Pat Buchanan, because I thought, well, at least they're white guys and they have their instincts are kind of right and they're popular, and we can use them still as bellwethers as to what's happening. But I see them more as a threat of basically siphoning off and wasting whatever outrage that whites might be building to here. In response to what the media is doing, and will squander it, and deliberately so, try and co-opt it and direct it off in a different direction. I mean, that is the strategy that's been used against us for decades now in this country. Nixon and the Southern strategy, it goes back probably earlier than that, to get white people to say the things that white people want to hear, and in this case, white people are upset about this. They've noticed this double standard on race with the Trayvon thing, and in the wake of it, the violence against whites. And so these white spokespeople who are the last people in the world that are going to say, as a white man, and I'm proud to be white, I say this in defense of white people. They will never say that. I'm not waiting for Beck or Limbaugh or Buchanan to say those things. They won't. And the minute that they do, if they were to do it, they would be gone from their media job because they're too in bed with the Jews.
So if what you're saying is they cannot identify as a white person. They don't really
identify. They won't positively identify as a white person. Yeah. The closest that they'll come is saying these things that they know appeal to white people in order to gobble up more listeners and get more money for themselves to be more popular. But I don't
they
think
seem to have no end of their desire for money. And, the greed is incredible because Limbaugh has to make tons of money. And he works out these contracts and he's got his contract people, working them out and to get to the best of his own advantage, you have to know. And when you think of the money they make, you just have a hard time relating to them as somebody who's really your champion, doing something for you.
You know, in William Pierce's other novel, The Hunter, the less well-known one, there's a theme in it, a plot element of a preacher that's secretly a racialist who wants to get the information about the Jews out. But he goes on initially as a sort of televangelist and gathers
Saul
up.
Paul Rogers.
There you go. And he's really good and like a Glenn Beck type of figure. And there was a time when Beck was saying things when he got fired from his job on TV and went off on his own. Finally, it was the Jews really who got too nervous about. He said, he named the 10 worst Americans or something, or the 10 worst people in the world, and 9 out of the 10 were Jews. The Jews got very upset about it, and they made sure that he was, it was the typical economic boycott. They got to all of his advertisers, and the ones who weren't directly Jewish, they said, well, we're going to boycott you if you don't, just cancel your advertising. But anyway, that's why Glenn Beck left Fox and went off on his own.
Well, and I've written about what happened to Glenn Beck at Fox. It appears to me that the boycotts and so forth didn't really have any effect. What happened finally was Glenn Beck started criticizing the agenda for regime change in the Middle East. And William Crystal got very irritated about that. And William Crystal apparently carries a lot of weight with Murdoch and Fox News.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I think that's what happened. All that other stuff didn't really matter that much. He got past even criticizing Reform Judaism. Because he could get away with that because he was pro-Israel.
Yes, and that explains why he went off on a trip to Israel right about the time just before leaving TV. He was probably feeling the pressure to do something to prove that he wasn't against Jews.
But
anyway,
I don't really agree with this common viewpoint that a lot of white nationalists seem to have, that people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh don't do any good, or even some people would say Buchanan doesn't do any good. I disagree with that. It depends on to whom they're speaking and in which direction they're moving their audience.
To whom they're speaking?
Yeah, if they're speaking to people who are inclined to be more extreme than they are, then they're putting a brake on them. If they're talking to people who are not quite that far along, like let's say Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor, he manages to get on to some mainstream radio shows and TV shows, Fox News and so forth, relatively mainstream. And he'll get on there and talk about racial differences and show that all this stuff that Bobby Jindal was saying is hooey. And influence a lot of people. A lot of people will see that and say, yeah, he's right. Some people will say, well, he didn't talk about the Jews. Well, so what? I mean, you know, the audience to whom he was speaking is not ready to hear about the Jews. You know, they're doing well just to keep their feet in racial reality so far as Negroes are concerned and so forth.
Yeah, I want to take issue with that. I think that business about they're not ready to hear about the Jews is not right. That's just
well. I'll put it this way: he couldn't get on all those shows.
Well, better than that he doesn't get on the shows, and that we have an even starker contrast between what the media is telling us and the reality that people can see in the real world of Jewish power.
I disagree. The way things change in politics is not through sudden changes. Things change gradually. It's like tectonic plate drift, right? You've got to work hard over a long period of time to get a real change. People want things to change suddenly because a particular viewpoint was put out. It just doesn't work that way. You used the example of Nixon's Southern strategy and how the Dixiecrats and that ilk just sort of got assimilated into the Republican Party. The problem isn't that they went into the Republican Party. Now, Nixon is not the bad guy there. The problem is that once they went into the Republican Party, they didn't maintain a distinct agenda and viewpoint. They kind of sat down and decided they were in the promised land, I suppose. You know?
I don't blame Nixon. Nixon was being a politician. He was advised by people whose advice was right in the end about how to win the election. What I blame is, I guess, white people for putting up with this coded language that appeals to them, not explicitly saying what the Jews' role is and that it's the Jews, and instead using code. And this speaking indirectly is not working for us. It's like trying to do surgery with oven mitts on. It's not – that is the one clear thing in the last 50 years and even before that – white people are not winning using the strategy of, okay, we'll pretend race doesn't matter. We'll pretend that Jews are white. We've been pretending that for several hundred years now, and it's not working for white people. It's time to stop that and start doing something different. I agree with your point about it takes long, concerted effort in a particular direction. It doesn't change immediately just because you want it to. But when things change, you can see a tipping point. And things change pretty radically, pretty quickly. But it does take a lot of effort and a lot of concerted effort, deliberate effort. It doesn't happen just by waiting for the thing to collapse and then, ooh, this is going to work better for us. It's got to be deliberate.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you think that Glenn Beck and for a lesser extent, Rush Limbaugh have any concerted, are putting forth any effort for this. Do they have this in mind, or are they just trying to do their thing and keep an audience and so on?
I think with Rush Limbaugh, he has arrived at a point where there's a kind of a parting of the ways between him and the leadership of the Republican Party. That may be the case, at least with some of them, because he was very critical of the Republican leadership, Republican bigwigs, around the time of the last presidential election. He blamed the leadership of the Republican Party for losing the election because they were not conservative enough. He said that if the Republican Party embraces amnesty for illegal aliens, the Republican Party will cease to exist. So the leadership of the Republican Party has pushed things so far to the left in some respects that Rush Limbaugh is starting to has already started to recoil from it, right? Now, I heard him talking on Friday, and he was talking about the loyalty of his audience. He said the reason why his audience is so loyal is because he says what they believe.
Yeah, well,
so
there you go.
You got two priorities.
He doesn't
there.
Say what he believes. He says what they believe.
Well, I think
I heard him saying that.
I think for the most part, what he says is what he believes also. Well, with certain qualifications. But you see, he used to be serving two gods.
Well, you know, I don't want to get too far into Rush Limbaugh here. Cause
well, I'm almost finished. Can you stop?
Okay, yes, go ahead.
Right. Yeah, he used to be serving two gods. You know, he was serving the Republican leadership. This was very obvious back when George W. Bush was president and Rush Limbaugh. A lot of his listeners were favorable to Ross Perot because they didn't like free trade and they were real conservatives. And then Rush Limbaugh gets invited to the White House. Next thing you know, he's solidly behind Pappy Bush. And that was very obvious. But now the leadership of the Republican Party has stretched things to such a point that he has recoiled away from them. And by default, he's more a servant of his audience than he used to be. So I think that's why. I think that's why he's talking more about these things like, well, he said at this commemoration of Martin Luther Coon, he said that you could bet that all they would talk about would be, or the main thing they would talk about would be Trayvon Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. So this is what has happened.
Yeah.
And I think it's
so
a good
thing. You have hope for Rush Limbaugh.
Well, you see, he's fundamentally flawed in some ways because he has supported free trade. He cannot be a proper representative of a really good path for white people in this country as long as he's advocating that kind of liberal ideology. He has to repent from that kind of bullshit. Excuse my language, but he needs to admit that he made some mistakes, you know, and that he could be a good spokesman if he did that. I think a constructive spokesman, you know, it's never going to be the ideal because he's too much interested in being popular, but he's moving in a better direction anyway.
Well, I think it doesn't make any difference what ideas he supports or doesn't support. As long as he doesn't say, I'm a white man, and as a white man, I think this or that is best for white people. That's the key. That's what's important. And everything else that he says then, at least white people can start thinking as white people and maybe argue with him about it. And what I don't like about Limbaugh is he perpetuates the left-right political theater that is doing us no good. That's part of the delusion or this indirection that we're thinking in terms of conservatives and liberals instead of in terms of white people. And as we'll get into in the next thing we discuss is who's white and what does that mean anyway? That's easier, I think, and it's makes more sense. It's more in tune with nature than this left-right dichotomy that just divides white people.
Okay. Well, let's go on now to this thing that I really want to talk about. This is an alternative right website. It's now called Alt-Right, Alt-Right. It used to be Richard Spencer, but he says he's the former editor of this, and now it's got some new editors, but they're all friends of his, and they're all kind of part of this clique. I might come up with these names later, but their latest blog post there is by this Julie Howard Hobson, who writes, has things published fairly often on Countercurrents. And now I don't follow Alt-Right, so I don't know if she's been here before, but they're featuring her article here, which is not at Countercurrents. I looked there for it, so it's just at Alt-Right. And it's called, in Latin, Mali Principi, Malus Fini, and that means bad beginnings have bad endings. So it's about paganism versus Christianity and therefore about, and what she calls the white folk. That's what I'm most interested in. And my comment here on this bad beginnings have bad endings, which is her title, reveals the deep hatred for Christianity of non-Christians and anti-Christians like herself. It really does, because she sees she's talking about the beginning of Christianity was bad and therefore it can only end badly. And they have this, you know, they're totally turned off to it. It'll never be any good and they have no room whatsoever for it. And that's all I'm trying to say there. And she starts out by saying, we as a people have no spiritual identity. Not that pan-Europeans lack spiritual impulse or spiritual distinctions, blah, 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 blah. We lack an identity of ourselves as a cohesive group and blah, blah, as members of our folk. And I was just surprised at this, that she was using the word folk with the capital F, you know, F-O-L-K, or which I is not only used for the German people for themselves, but it's most commonly known that way. But she was using it for pan-Europeanism, for all Europeans, which is what she's gonna think of as all white people everywhere as being a folk. So I just thought, you can't call all Europeans a folk. And I still don't think so, but that's the first question, guys. What do you think of that, that we can be a folk, all of us?
Well, I'm glad you're broaching the subject. I've heard your discomfort in many previous episodes where you've talked about white nationalism, and you say, I don't like the term white nationalism, and I'm against it. And I have wanted to come on as a counterpoint to that. And I don't think I'll argue as extreme a pan-Europeanism as, you know, you might expect. I just want to make a few points about this essay and about pan-Europeanism in general. As far as folk goes for the entire European people, there is a sense in which that's true. And it's, you have to keep in mind that race is a continuum. It's not this thing that there's a hard a boundary between where it stops making sense as to how related somebody is to you. How related somebody is to you is the continuum I'm talking about that is race. And I see race as extending all the way down to the family and all the way up to the continental races that most people would identify with the word race. They think black, white, yellow, red, that level of race. That's the coarsest, largest scale example of it. But you can see that race is really just heredity. And it comes up also in the debate about whether the Jews are a race or not. And I would say, well, they're not a race in the continental sense of the word, but they are a race in the sense that Jewishness is about peoplehood. It's about heritage. It's about who your parents are. And in that sense, it's race. Ethnicity is race because it's just a finer grained racialism. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying folk doesn't just apply, I think, to, say, the German folk, the German people, and something that narrow. It can apply on a smaller scale even than that. It can apply on a bigger scale as well.
Well, you can use it. You can say it. It sounds all right to say, you know, sounds. But, I mean, on a practical level, you can't function as a folk, as the entire European descended people. She says, for the folk, and by this I mean the European and European descended peoples. And then she says, a little further down, whether Irish or Hungarian or Greek, we as Europeans are cohesively stuck being non-people of color living in a multi-culti-colored world redesigned to accommodate everyone except us. Well, that's all right. That speaks to our situation now. But that's sort of changing it. First, she says, you know, we're one folk, one people, and then she's, you know, uses these other says we're all being persecuted today in today's world, and so we need to hold together. But let's see, what else does she say here? Okay, she says, now here's something I thought sounded Jewish, which may be true for everybody, though. The true spirituality, : the race, tribe, or nation is linked to the gods in a unique relationship. Gods and people might be thought of as expressions of each other. So she's saying that, you know, that she's saying, just like you were talking about in one of your shows recently, maybe the last one or the one before, that we are God, that the race, the tribe, the people is God. And, we invent our God, and that God is ours alone.
Yeah, if I didn't say it during talking about the Jews, I think it's a good thing. It's a very powerful thing to think of your people, your in-group, is God, and everybody else sucks. What did Tadding? You said the American Indian tribes, their name for themselves was human, and everybody else was not.
A number of American Indian tribes whose name for themselves means human being. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's perfectly normal and natural. We see from these examples.
But
it's also what you need to perpetuate yourself. People who don't think that way, people who go around pretending that race doesn't matter, they cease to exist. So you you mentioned this line that I thought was very good too, this business about we Europeans are cohesively stuck being non-people of color living in a multicolored world. That's an interesting way of putting it, because a lot of times people criticize the pan-European white as being whiteness is nothing but not black. And you know where that really falls down is when you compare whiteness to people of color. Because it's actually people of color that you can say that about. People of color just means not white. That's what it means. And so the criticism that white isn't real, that it doesn't exist, that it's not a folk, that it's not cohesive enough, is obviously false, because this people of color is defined in terms of whiteness, which supposedly doesn't exist. And people seem to be able to politically organize in terms of people of color and talk and have conferences and all this other stuff. Now, you could say it's not a very strong coalition. It's very brittle. It'll fall apart at the slightest push. They'll fight amongst each other. That's absolutely right, and so will white people. In the absence of any other enemy, of course, white people will start fighting amongst themselves. What's odd about today's situation is that white people are being flooded with aliens in our faces now, and we're still not cohesing. We're still not seeing that we have more in common with each other, no matter what part of Europe we're from, than with these total aliens that hate us amongst us. And that I would attribute to the constant Jewish propaganda telling us that is the last thing that you want to think. Racism is bad. That makes you stupid and it makes you crazy. It makes you evil. And so white people have, you know, surrounded watching their TVs all the time and seeing Bobby Jindal there as a role model out there. A lot of them fall for this fraud. I mean, that's the thing about fraud, is it works at least some of the time, until it stops working, and then you have a dramatic change where people realize, hey, wait a minute, I've been frauded all this time. I'm going to put an end to this, because something in my head clicks. I realize that this is a lie I've been sold, and I'm going to stop buying the lie, and I'm going to go find the guy who sold it to me, and I'm going to make him pay. That's the secret. That's the lock that we have to unlock here.
Okay, well, agreed. But now she's a pagan. She's promoting paganism, and she says the old ways are part of who we all are. And she talks about us as a that's down at the bottom here. But okay, when she says that, she's kind of like, in order to be all this one European folk, the codes, the ways, the values, etc., she says, are the ideals, are the deepest impulses of our folk. These pagan, heathen, ancient ways, be they from, and then she starts with Austria and ends with Wales, and names what I'm sure is every nation and national region in Europe, and even onto the edges, you know, but not just go into Turkey or anything. She just includes places like, some of them are a little further.
Yeah, the most far flung looks like
Herzegovina, but those are, that's right. So she says, these old ways are a part of who we are. We need to go back to that. But see, I don't relate to them. I don't relate to these old ways. I mean, they're so old.
But that's because you have this narrow concept, which is not an invalid concept, to feel proud of your relatively near in time relations to your close German relatives, your German heritage, your pure German heritage. That makes you feel more favorably towards Germans and less towards everybody else. Someone like me, who's more mixed, feels I have more of an affinity all over Europe with different parts of Europe. I can see that. Why that makes sense even is when you dig into the history, the racial history of Europe, it's a series of invasions, waves of peoples populating Europe. A good source on this is William Pierce's Who We Are, which is a document. I don't think Pierce himself generated the whole thing. He might have had a little hand in it, but he had an academic Hadding might be able to describe how that came to be.
Let's not go into that. I don't want to talk about William Pierce's thing.
I didn't want to talk about William Pierce either, but that is a source where I get my information as to the idea of what the substrate is that we're working with here, and that is two successive waves, basically, with minor waves composing each, and the first wave being settling Europe after the ice was receding, and those are the old Europeans. There's a genetic footprint in the I haplotype that you can see still peeking through.
Yeah, but can you go back to that? Can you?
No, I'm just trying to explain why I think the what we see, the little wrinkles on top of the ocean that we see today, are reflect this deeper substrate underneath, and the dual nature. The invading Aryans that came and conquered those peoples and had different ways of seeing things. That's, I think, what she's getting at in her article here, talking about these more traditional, older ways that keep bubbling up through Christianity. We could talk more about
that. But how do we act on that today? That's what I'm going to talk about in the next
hour. No, you're right about that,
starting out. I mean, how do we talk about that? How do we organize along those lines? I don't think it's possible. And that's really the point that I'm making. Not that that's not where we come from.
Yeah, the ethnic and national identity is stronger.
Yeah. So when we get back, ladies and gentlemen, we'll go into that. I'm a little bit. We're going to have Frank Reneke's song here tonight, as we usually have for the break music, and then we'll be back. And I'm going to go into this. We're going to have this out here about. How we should identify, how we can identify in order to make some progress in our gaining power. Okay.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt. Und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer. Aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn, was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Die starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Die starben an vielen Tagen hinterm Stacheldraht. Arbeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on... I'm hearing a phone ringing on August 26th, 2013. And I'm here with Tan Stoffel and Hadding Scott. And hi. And we've got now we've got a thing going here on how far out does white nationalism extend, or how far does the white folk extend? And of course it brings in the old religion of the old pagan religions as being preferable to the to Christianity and so on, and how Christianity destroyed all of our old ways, which we should bring back, and my problems with that. Now, I want to just start out, though, if I might, to say that Tan, today you brought up this this interview that Tom Sunick did some time back. Yes. On Voice of Reason with Andrew Fraser. And I listened to it, and we might talk about that a little bit, too.
Yes, I'd like to.
Yeah, but he, one of the lines that Fraser said that I liked very much was, "You're never going to get the Germans to identify as a people again by forcing them to think of themselves as simply white." And this is my point, is that if we go to this we're all white business, you know, which I'm not against white. I identify as white. But white, what? There's no country called white. There's no nationality called white.
That's true.
White,
that's true.
White
I
is
would
our
say,
is a race. Okay, go ahead.
In response to Fraser's point about the Germans, I would agree, first of all, that the Germans should think of themselves as Germans first. But that those two terrible wars might have been avoided if they Germans and the English had thought of themselves as cousins rather than as nasty, evil people.
Well, I think they knew they were cousins, and in spite of that, you know, there certainly is family warfare that goes on. And
well, for some reason, they were blind, and Germany wasn't blind.
Tan Stoffel, you've got like half the story right there.
I wish I could finish. There's just something.
Yeah, I'd like to finish.
I'd like to finish because I was starting out this topic, see, and I was going to start.
Okay, you want to do the rest of the show?
All right, come on. I wanted to say this. That when I've looked at my own situation, I realize what I feel comfortable with, you know, and I think it's very important for people to have that feeling of comfort about what they're, you know, what they belong to and so on. And I come from a long line of Southern German Catholics. And I'm comfortable with that. And I wasn't brought up Catholic myself. And I'm not, and I don't want to be Catholic, but I don't have to be. But I certainly went into churches, you know, with my family members and so on, and at times. And then there was funerals and weddings and all these really important things that go on as you're growing up, you know, that involved the Catholic Church. So I always felt this connection, even though I was not really a part of it. So, and that's, you know, in the full sense. So it's one of those funny kind of things. But I think that to say, well, I'm going to connect with my pagan ancestors from God knows where and how long ago, and I know what the church did to those European people. It was terrible, just terrible. I know all of that. But still, at the same time, we are what we are, and I don't think we go back that deeply. And I don't think that we can ever identify in a way that we have emotional feeling and really get deeply moved to protect and something that is just white.
And that
encompasses so many different people, because we're talking about a whole lot of very different European types of people.
Imagine how you would feel about your Germanness if you didn't know about it. Okay, that's the state that most white people have, including, I would say, Andrew Fraser, who doesn't seem to appreciate the deeper roots of European peoples, that we have more in common with each other. Where, you know, Andrew Fraser, one of the things he said in that Sunak interview was, well, white's just not black. It's a negative identity. And he's full of crap. That's, you know, people of color, you could say that about, that it's defined in terms of not being white. That's true. And white, to a certain extent, there is a little bit of truth in what he says, in that white people don't identify as white. Germans and English don't get together and say, hey, we're white people, until they see something in contrast that's darker than themselves, more alien than themselves. I agree with that. Anyway, Hadding, go ahead. I'll shut up.
Okay, I have a chance to speak without being cut off now.
Oh, come on. Just speak.
Well, you do it all the damn time. It pisses me off.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, what I was going
turn.
To say. Okay, goodbye.
Well, there you go. See? Touchy,
Hadding.
Touchy.
Yeah, come on, Hadding.
Maybe he'll come back. But, you know, I said when we get back from the break, I'm going to explain this. And I just wanted to get that much out, because I think that it's important in the sense that we have to what we identify with. And I wonder what people are, you know, if you are a European and you're living in Europe and you're one of these nationalities, you have a different view of it, I would think, than if you're an American or even Canadians and Australians have some connection, I guess, with England, you think?
Yes. Look, I think it is important. That's why people argue about it. That's why people get so impassioned about it. I understand that European position of, hey, I'm German first, and why should I care about whiteness? Or even Andrew Fraser's position about, I'm Anglo-Saxon, and I'm interested in an Anglo-Saxon identity. What I think is disingenuous, though, from some of these people, is the way they dismiss the idea, the broader sense, a broader identity. And it's not a fair argument to make, because the arguments that they make against, say, pan-Europeanism could also be made against pan-Germanism. It could be made against British identity, which is really just a composite itself. Even Anglo-Saxonism is a composite identity that you could break down further. If you want to be like a Jew and break things down, you can always find differences to drive wedges into and to exploit. And I don't make the argument that whiteness is what we should all consider to be our first and foremost, most important identity. It's that it would be impossible to demand of people. But I would like to see us avoid the infighting that we have amongst each other when we have other more alien enemies. And to that point about the war, what I would have liked to have seen the German leadership do is get together with the British leadership, the English leadership, and say, look, we have more in common with each other, and our countries have more in common with each other than these Jews who are living amongst us, controlling our media, controlling our finances. We need to throw them off our backs collectively. And that's, I think, the sense that a lot of pan-Europeans come at the problem of from is we need to unite in order to deal with this common enemy who's too strong. Provably, throughout history, has dealt with each of us on an individual basis and broken each of us down one at a time. That's why it's important to see our common problem and handle it with a common solution.
Well, you know, I know what you're saying there, and that's right. You're saying, you know, and that most pan-Europeans and white nationalists and so on say, well, they're kind of they're kind of mixed on it. They say, I understand that ethnic nationalism is the strongest feeling that people have, and we don't want to lose that. But at the same time, we can't let these things cause differences between us so that we can't work together for the common good. And so we have to override that when necessary and come together as white people or just what you're saying there. But how do you do both? I mean, it's kind of asking a lot. And it seems to me that if it's possible, if we encourage people's nationalism, people's nationalist feelings, if they have them, they don't all have them, to get power, let's say our ethnic power in our own countries, that would be the strongest thing that we could do. But you're right, then we're not one big unit. I don't quite know how to get to be one big unit and have it work without it becoming internationalized and actually more open to Jewish intervention than less.
Yeah, as far as white nationalism goes, what it means to me is that having this understanding about what white means, that it's this collective identity of Europeans in general, you know, in a loose sense. As a white nationalist, I like the fact that nationalism seems to be surging in Greece. I'm not Greek in any way. I think that they're on the borders of being white. I wouldn't want to share a country with Greeks, but I have positive feelings toward their nationalism. I would even support it with my wallet if it came to that. Support it with my life to a certain extent, amount that I thought I could afford it, but I would feel even better about German nationalism. I would feel even better about English nationalism, French nationalism, more Northwestern European. My affinity is more Northwestern European in that sense. But I don't see any contradiction there that a white nationalist there's this caricature of a white nationalist as being some stupid American who doesn't understand the differences, the very real and significant differences between the different European ethnicities and nationalities, and thinks, oh, well, you know, all Europeans are the same and they should just get together and form one big country in order to throw off the Jew or for whatever other reason, stop all the fighting. Sunak maybe goes a little bit in that direction. And that was one of the telling things I thought in his interview with Fraser was Fraser mentioned after talking all this time about he wants to see Anglo-Saxon people stand up for themselves and think of themselves first and drop the liberalism that he thinks is destroying them. He mentions how his son is dating a girl, and it's a Russian girl. And Sunak goes, oh, that's great. That's great news, which is exactly wrong. Fraser, of course, is devastated by that. Fraser would like his Anglo-Saxon son to marry an Anglo-Saxon girl. And I think to myself, more power to Andrew Fraser. That's fine. But Tom Sunak has this idea of, well, as long as a white person marries another white person, well, it's okay, which is a little bit odd.
No, not only that, he thinks it's better if white people from different ethnic groups marry one another, because he wants to mix this all up. Yeah. And I don't think that makes for a stronger group of people. I was studying at one time this work by Ludovici. Wasn't it about breeding and what makes what causes the best stock to be born and so on, and how to do all that, and when you mix that's why I put that picture in there for the program page for today. We've got four different European types. Of course, one was a Turk. That's not really European. But they had him on that group, so I had to leave him in there. But when they're so very different, they can be very different. And when when you have intermarriage with these people, it's not bad for white people to marry white people, but it's better if they marry within their closer community than if they marry from far out, because you get the grain from what is supposed to be, healthy. But I think that inbreeding is not really a bad thing if you know how to go about it.
Well, there's a sweet spot of too much inbreeding is not good, but too much outbreeding is not good either. There's a sweet spot in between. And the Jews have actually hit that sweet spot. It's something like the fifth cousin thing that came up in your Saturday afternoon show. That's the biological sweet spot, according to some criteria. I don't recall at the moment.
Well, yeah, and another one is that if you once you breed out the negative traits or the problems, then you're going to have, this is what they do with animals, then you're just going to have, you're just going to breed the same type over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's, and I think there's nothing wrong with types, you know?
No,
if it's
there
a good type.
What's his name? Wilmot Robertson's The Ethnostate. He made a book-length case for coherent, cohesive, ethnically pure or ethnically, you know, more pure than what we have today, more like the German or more like the European states of old, that is the optimal form of state to have, that you have a political boundary that surrounds, that contains a people that have religion and language and history and heroes and myths in common with each other, that minimizes the infighting then. And we see the opposite. Diversity is destructive to that. And going back further, Gobineau, Arthur de Gobineau's book, 150 years ago now, his theory was that race mixing basically is what causes degeneracy, that the cycle of societies rising and falling was due to a collective small set of clans that had struck upon some innovation. And I'm paraphrasing now, this is not his words, but my sort of understanding of it. And they were so successful that they would conquer the local people first, and then they would start conquering their neighbors, and then ultimately they would become race mixed with their neighbors. Now, he was talking about Europeans. And so in this older sense of race, and like I said, race is a continuum. In the old days, they used to talk about race, and they didn't think of continental race, you know, Africans and Asians. They were talking about the races of Europe. And Gobineau mm-hmm. specifically was talking about just the different clans, the different races of people, the Greeks being a race of people, the ancient Greeks, and as opposed to the Roman, the initial founders of Rome, and so on. And based on the lessons of that history that he was familiar with, he came up with this thesis of the rise and fall of societies and civilizations. And the fall is due to degeneracy, which he defined basically as diluting your race, the original race of successful people. Now, Gobineau is one of those authors whose books you can't find anymore. He was very popular at the time. This is 1850s, 1860s. He published this book. The title escapes me at the moment. Something about the inequality of human races. That's it. But this is one of the books that when World War II was over, the Jews marched back through history and they found every thread, that every root of National Socialism that there was, every significant figure that contributed in some way. Gobineau was one of them, and they, you know, do what they always do. They blotted out their name from history, you know, and where they couldn't blot them out entirely, stop publishing their books, they, you know, heaped opprobrium on them so that everybody knew if you go anywhere near that person, you're going to be radioactive. So you don't talk, even though Gobineau didn't talk about the Jews, I think he made like one or two little mentions of the Jews. And that's what I find throughout history is these people, the great thinkers of European history, were sort of blindsided to a large extent by the Jews. They thought the Jews were just this, you know, ancient people with a weird religion. And, you know, they made up these theories about Europe that completely left the Jews out. And as we know now, in retrospect, as I said, the Jews did not just swoop in and inherit what the Europeans left behind, you know, by stupidly fighting amongst ourselves. They caused the fighting between us. They hyped these ethnic and national differences and profited from it. And the main profit is that they're in charge now. They run things.
Well, that's right. That's what I think. You see, it's not that emphasizing ethnic, I will say differences, but, you know, ethnicities and ethnic pride and so on is going to lead to war and fighting and hate and so on. Sure, there'll be certain competition.
It does when the Jews run your media.
Yes. But if the Jews get in there, you see, it's the Jews that do that. And that's always the part that's ignored or left out or not talked about. We're not able to talk about it. But, you know, I just don't see that European ethnic variety is is something that, like they always want to say, all these wars were caused by nationalism. Nationalism causes war. But nationalism does not cause war. And nationalism is simply the same thing as the ethnic diversity in, say, Europe amongst white people. And that's not what causes it. So it's instigated. Yeah, it's instigated from the outside. So here's another thing, and let's see, Hadding is still on the call, so let's see if he'll come back in after I say this and say what he wants to say. Interview, and you know, I'm not a fan of Tom Sunich, because for one thing, I just don't like his delivery method. But he likes paganism. He doesn't like Christianity. And this Andrew Fraser, seems to be kind of pro-Christian, huh? Or sort
he's,
of? I
he's
mean.
Pro-Church of England as an institution. He sees it as something around which the Anglo-Saxon people can rally. That it was their, it's crap today. Of course, it's leading the way off the cliff today, helping to. But in the past, at least, he traces the roots back of Anglo-Saxon identity to include this religious component way back.
Okay, and so it seems like when we get into the subject of white ethnicity or white tribalism or white folk, it's connected all the time with whether it's Christian or pagan, you know, with the difference between Christians and pagans. And I don't know how that exactly fits in, but I think that I'm usually on the side of the people who are of the Fraser type and not the Sunnic type. So, because the Sunnic doesn't like too much nationalism either. In fact, he talks about petty nationalism. That's one thing that just drives me up a wall when I hear him. He always has to call it that. Petty nationalism. We have to get rid of these petty nationalisms.
Well, that's not a white nationalist in my view. I mean, but that's, I wouldn't be arrogant enough to say that I define what white nationalism, which is what the people who criticize white nationalists for being like Tom Sunich, because he calls himself a white nationalist. How can you be a nationalist and talk about petty nationalism? That's
well, because he doesn't want different, because he's Croatian, and Croatia has had these fights and battles with the other, Serbia and the other nations down in the Balkans and so on. That's always been a big battleground. And, but that doesn't mean it's the same with everybody else in Europe. And, you have to take that approach for that reason. Then he'll bring up Germany and Poland. Well, there's real problems between Germany and Poland. And I don't think you can sweep them under the rug by saying, well, we're just all white. We're not going to be Germans or Poles or something. I think Hadding's here. Hadding, you want to say something?
Well, I think that the Jews actually owe a large amount of their cohesion and therefore their success to the fact that they are highly inbred. They're like any breed of animal that is highly inbred and has predictable responses. They react in unison more or less to events, and the more we mix ourselves with different stocks, the less we're going to have unity among ourselves. This slogan, "Our diversity is our strength," is exactly the opposite of the truth. We should, if we want to have strong character to resist pressures in our descendants, we should marry people genetically very similar to ourselves. So that Andrew Fraser was correct in believing that a Russian woman's probably not the best choice for his son. But it can work out all right, depending on how dominant their own type is.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. That's well said, and that's how I see it.
Yeah, and I would add only that there's an ideological component as well, a mimetic component, that the genetics doesn't just happen on its own, that it works in concert with this, the ideas that the Jews, for instance, stay cohesive because they make a concerted effort to teach their children, you're Jews, and this is what it means to be a Jew, and it's very important, and you need to find yourself another Jew to marry to continue the line, which has gone on for, you know, 3,000, 5,000 years, whatever their idea is. And that even though it's a kind of, talk about a negative identity, we are the most oppressed people in the world. We've always been oppressed. We've always been kicked out, and it's always the other people's fault. That's the Jewish identity, and yet it works. The whining and complaining that they do works. And I think it works because not only are they genetically similar to each other, but then they have this cohesive, on the same page idea about themselves as Jews. You know, at the core, they have all sorts of arguments about and all sorts of different flavors of Jews. And they use, as you've pointed out several times, Hadding, the they do get into bed with the peoples, the host population amongst whom they're infiltrating. That's one of the techniques that they use to break down the host society, is to compromise that society. That's the first step in the compromise, is to crawl, some of them crawl into bed with that, the host peoples, especially the powerful peoples. And that's what Europe's undoing was. That's why the British stampeded their peoples to war against the Germans, who were their racial cousins, because they were in bed at the top levels with Jews. And there's the sexual component, the actual biological component, but they were also even more involved financially, business sense. So even though some of the British nobility at the time, or the elite class amongst the British, and this is to a certain extent true of America too, hated the Jews, resented the Jews, didn't think of the Jews as themselves, and wanted them out, they still saw a sort of modus vivendi of, well, you know, I can get rich working with them, and these nasty humanless Germans they were believing the propaganda printed by the Jews. The Germans just want to rule the world, and that's not going to be any fun. So, you know, all right, I'll go along with the Jews. We need to know all of this stuff and know that in retrospect, at least, we can see that was a big mistake. Those people made a mistake thinking they could deal with the Jews and that was the right decision to make, and they're paying the price now for it, or their descendants are, at least, because even the white people who went along with the Jews now are being thrown off. They're being treated just like all the other poor white folk that had no idea what was going on up at these upper levels.
Right. Okay. Is there any more to say about that? Because we've got two more things we want to get to: Martin Luther King and also a little bit on Leo Frank. So let's see what
we can
finish up on this one.
That Tanstoffel was half right in what he said about Germany, because Germany, the Germans being very nationalistic, also were also very there was a great love of all things British in Germany in the 19th century, and this continued through the 20th century, even to some extent today, this love of all things English.
You consider that to be all the way through the German population?
It's a very strong tendency. You see it even in Mein Kampf. Hitler wanted very much to be friendly with Britain.
Oh, Hitler wanted it, but I'm saying, do you think it went through all the German people that they all had that? Hitler certainly had it.
It's a very strong tendency. The reason why it wasn't reflected on the British side is because Britain is a plutocratic society where the wealthy people rule. And the wealthy people don't even feel kinship really with the poor people in their own country, of their own race. So, of course, that kind of racial kinship thing doesn't come to anything in Britain. You know, that's the problem. The malfunction was on the British side there, not on the German side at all.
Oh, I agree. The Germans had recognized the parasite and had thrown it out, had freed itself, and the British didn't and couldn't. I don't know exactly why, but that, I think, is the problem. So I don't see.
Well,
what
he's but he's saying that the British don't even have the ruling class of Britain doesn't even have a sense of race.
The upper middle class. Yeah, well, yes, they bring in all this cheap foreign labor to undermine their own workers.
Well, you have to account for the parasitism since the Norman invasion in 1066, and then after Cromwell, the Jews have been had their claws into the British elite, into the English elite, and you know that has an effect. It's not negligible. It's not just a failing of the English people or even the English elite. It's they're to a certain extent not even English.
It's not strictly a problem of Jews. It's there's also a segment of the white society there that is despicably money oriented.
Yes, I would agree with that. They're the ones who thought that they could deal with the Jews. Yeah.
When you have that kind of when you have a substantial element like that in a nation, then the Jews can move in and pretty much swim like fish in water, you know? They're at home in a place like that, and they've got plenty of allies.
And my point is that this is because they are unaware of the larger racial truth, that the Jews are different racially, that their future, they think they're tying their cart to a winning horse, that they're going to benefit in the long term. I think that they don't benefit, but, you know, that's the thing about what's good for us and determining who us is it's up to us to decide who us is, each person individually. And out of that, a collective arises. And then the collective has to decide, well, what's good for us collectively? And it's going to be different people, different individuals are going to have different opinions about that. But I think my argument is that in retrospect, we can see that the people, the elites who decided to ally themselves with the Jews over the Germans were wrong. And we can see it because today, Britain is full of not only, the fear in World War II was, oh, no, we've got to fight the Germans because we don't want to be ruled by the Germans. We don't want to be invaded by the Germans and told what to do by the Germans. And so now what have they got? They've got a bunch of Pakistanis and a bunch of Caribbean Africans and a bunch of...
I don't think that was the real fear. I think the real fear was the spread of the National Socialist idea into Britain.
Amongst the elites, maybe, yeah. But the people... Yes. The masses that were moved and stampeded to go to war were animated by this idea of I've got to fight for king and country and to protect my shores from the Boche. And the Germans were painted as aliens, these despicable aliens that want to tell you how to live your life. And basically what I'm saying is that the nightmare came true. It's just the different peoples. Instead of the Germans, which never had those designs anyway to do that to the English people or the British people, that instead it really happened, but it was even more alien people. And it's because of the Jewish influence that goes back way back in England.
Okay, well, let's go on to, somebody tried to call, but I think it might be Don, who every time I answer his call, it disappears. So I don't know what the problem is there with that number of his. But people can call if they want to at this point, if you have something kind of brief. We want to go on to Martin Luther King. I should give the number 830-1830-443-4911. But you know this King thing, it's not just one day, and this is just his speech. There's so many Martin Luther King celebrations, but this is 50 years ago, so it's big. That he gave that I Have a Dream speech, but that's on the 28th, that's 2 days from now on Wednesday, but they're celebrating from Saturday until then. This is multi-days that all these black people arrived in Washington. Who's paying for all that, you know, and where are all these people staying? Of course, there's a lot of blacks in Washington, D.C. already. And they're all there out there on the mall, and they're having speeches by people like Al Sharpton. I guess he already gave his. And Eric Holder. Ooh. And Nancy Pelosi. And who else is here? And then, of course, on Wednesday, President Barack Obama, the U.S. president himself, he, of course, he's a black guy, but still, you know, the president is going to speak on that day, the anniversary of this I Have a Dream, which just shows that this whole thing, and this not just King himself, but this whole thing is just enshrined as one of the mainstays now of U.S. whatever identity, of United States identity. And we're all supposed to, you know, bow down like this is he's greater than George Washington. In fact, nobody cares about George Washington anymore, I guess. So what would you both like to say about that? Hattie might not be listening. Go ahead, Tan.
Well, what I would say is it's disgusting to me on just on an intellectual level. Even what they're celebrating, they're not being honest about what they're celebrating. What they're celebrating is really that black people are now elevated above white people, that white people are now subordinate. And yet they are pretending it's all about equality and fairness and colorblindness. And as we said during the our analysis of that Bobby Jindal thing, that race is in the news every day, and it's whites being pummeled, being blamed for creating the problems. Even in objecting, even in this surge, this recent surge of white people starting to say, "Hey, wait a minute, you know, this white person, that white person have been victimized by blacks. Where's the media? Why isn't the media reporting on this?" And making that the national story is that white people are starting to notice this and are upset about it. It's not good for us that they're still celebrating Martin Luther King as if he's some sort of faultless saint. And it's
go ahead.
I think white people are just about at the point of gagging on all this stuff. You know, after all this Trayvon Martin crap, you know, who the hell wants to hear about Martin Luther King? My God. And they're going to be, and just like what Rush Limbaugh said, they'll be up there talking about Trayvon Martin all the time, which is good. Let them do that. Let them identify their whole civil rights movement with Negro thugs that get gunned down in the process of committing a crime. Let them do that. That'll be fantastic.
So you think they're going to bring up Trayvon Martin in these talks? You think Obama will?
Well, Rush said it must be true.
Oh, okay.
No, I think I agree that they will, but not because Rush said it, but just because. Rather, the Jewish strategy is not to run away from a weakness. It's to put it right out front and talk about it as if it's a strength. And that's the key to understanding the whole Trayvon Martin thing, is instead of being defensive about the fact that Trayvon Martin was obviously a thug, they don't face that and say, well, yeah, he was a thug, and I guess we should just be quiet about this. No, they put it right out front that he is a saint, that he was a little baby, so innocent, that he's comparable to their other saint, this Martin Luther King, who wasn't a saint in reality either.
Oh, I don't see how they could make him comparable to that. That would be wild. Well,
that's because you're
a white
person. You don't sympathize with that.
By the way, we have a caller on the line. So let's see. Caller, welcome, and please give us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Doug from Chicago.
Hi, Doug.
Hi, Carolyn. I work at this time, and I haven't really listened to this particular show that you guys are doing right now, but so I really don't feel qualified to comment on this particular show, but I just wanted to tell you, all three of you, that you guys do a really great job. I haven't really heard anything in revisionism or white nationalism quite like you guys, and yeah, there's been a big void since Dr. Pierce died in 2002, and I just wanted to say I think you guys do a great job, and keep it up, and I'd like to call sometime when I have actually listened to the show so I can actually make an intelligent comment.
Well, thank you, Doug. And, you know, thanks for calling and telling us that. You know, how long have you been listening to the White Network?
Personally, you're great. I believe you wrote an article about the Neanderthals for the Barnes Review.
No, that wasn't me.
Well, that wasn't you. Were you tied to that somehow?
I talked about it on a radio program.
Okay, you
do remember that.
And that was my first encounter, and then it's been a couple of years. I download all of your shows and listen to them on an iPod while I work and go to the gym. And I just think you guys are great.
Well, thanks very much. We appreciate that.
You're welcome. And keep up the good work. And I'd like to call back when I've actually listened to the show.
Yeah, do that.
Thank you very much. Would hanging up cause you a problem?
No, go ahead. We can deal with it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye, Doug.
Thanks, Carolyn. Bye.
I was hoping we'd get a call for somebody just calling in and say, gee, I appreciate what you're all doing. And then we did. So,
well, I could echo that and say that, when I first heard you on Voice of Reason, I went back through the archives and got every one of your shows and downloaded it and listened to it from beginning to end and thoroughly enjoyed it. And that's why, I've partnered with you to help you continue that work.
Well, thank you. I'm like Michael Collins Piper. He always said, when I listen to my shows, I can't imagine why anybody will listen to them. Because he thought his voice was so bad. But I often think that, too. I think, oh, my God, why would anybody be listening to this? But anyway, thankfully they do. We had another undisclosed number caller, but he hung up. So let's continue on then with whoever was talking and if there was more to say about Martin Luther King here. I think it's really important. It's an important topic because of what they've turned him into. And, it's totally racial. They talk about us not being racial. But this is supposed to be overcoming some kind of old racialism in the United States. And we're supposed to, until we all just see these black people as not black or something like that, we're not going to have, overcome this. It's just the goal is so totally unreasonable. All I know Hadding was saying that I thought what I did because I was a white person.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, as a white person, you don't see how it can possibly make sense for poor little Trayvon Martin, the thug, to be equated with the Reverend Dr. King. It didn't make sense to you, but that's because you're a white person. You expect things to make sense.
Yeah.
You're not the kind of person that blames a guy for shooting a thug that's pounding his head into the concrete, there's all kinds of things that don't make sense to you as a white person. See, that's kind of a fallacy there, assuming that these other people think the way we do.
And that we're supposed to understand them and think the way that they think, and be able to relate to them and, not feel different. And, I just absolutely, reject that. We're not the same kind of people. Just look at us. We're never going to be the same kind of people, and we shouldn't have to be trying to do it.
Well,
yeah, and
sure.
Trayvon Martin Luther King thing, again, that may be, could very well be another phenomenon that produces a parting of the ways, where they've pushed things too far. Just as with the Republican leadership wanting to give amnesty to illegal aliens and alienating people like Rush Limbaugh, could be that all this Martin Luther King celebration will alienate people, especially if they incorporate Trayvon Martin into it. People that have been pretending that Martin Luther King really was worthy of respect may have second thoughts about it.
Well, when they put a pimp like this... what's his name now? I forgot his name. Sharpton guy in there in Washington, D.C., and put him on his steps in front of this big memorial, and he's giving a big talk, and we're all supposed to listen to him, and that's just pathetic, This horrible man. And now I don't find it here, but I read it on this, I think on this page or on another page, that this the words of the speech, I Have a Dream speech, have been inscribed on the steps, I guess on the down part of the steps of the National Memorial, but I didn't understand what National Memorial they were talking about.
Oh, the Martin Luther King statue that they just put up.
Do they have steps on that?
Maybe, I don't know.
Well, that's what it said. Well, if it's on the Martin Luther King statue, it's okay. But if it's somewhere else, it's not. But, you know, the way they write this stuff, they do it so that you don't know what they're talking about.
I'd like to make a point that, you know, the famous statement, the part of his speech that's famous is about judging people not by the color of the skin, but the content of their character. And for the last 50 years, conservative, quote-unquote conservative whites have been trying to do just that, judging people, and the party and officially has decided to judge people based on principles, political principles and so forth, that are race blind, at least on the surface. They can't hide instincts, and things like alienation are natural instincts. But I would say that after 50 years, it's time to give up, guys. You've been trying to judge people based on their character. And when you talk about racial IQ, the differences between black IQ and white IQ, or in violent crime, you can see that blacks by character are different. And you, even if you judge them by character, you still get pummeled for being a racist. Mm-hmm. And likewise with the Jews, of course, in their character, their deceitful, treacherous character.
Okay, we've got another caller. It doesn't sound like it's very good quality, though. Hello, caller. What is your name and where are you calling from?
Hello. Hello. This is Abraham Goldstein from Southern California.
Okay, well, you sound like somebody I know, but...
how's it going?
Oy vey. No, this is Don, yeah.
Don, right.
Hi, Don.
Yeah, just a little moment of levity there.
You finally got through. Amazing.
Yes, I finally did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say about the Martin Luther King thing, I studied this, you know, the only people who are fooled by this content of the character are dull-witted white people. If you read all of his speeches and all of his works, and the black intellectuals are very much onto this, they very much agree that he never would have been opposed to affirmative action. And you read his stuff, he talked about there would be a need for remedial measures so that black people could catch up and be truly equal and be judged on the content of their character. He didn't mean they would be judged on the content of their character now. He meant they would be judged on it, assumingly, when they finally, through evolution or whatever, 10,000 years from now, actually developed some.
It would be more than 2,000 years. Europeans are at least 100,000 years separated from Africans.
And Hal Turner, the discredited racist talk radio show host, once said something very interesting. He said, "We've seen black character, and frankly, it stinks." So that's kind of my view on the whole thing. But Jack Staple was right about how blacks have been elevated above whites. The whole purpose of the civil rights movement and the whole purpose of the King rhetorical kind of Orwellian type of deal is not equality. It is to elevate blacks to the superior status as a creditor race and to relegate white people to a subordinate status as a debtor race. You keep hearing them talk about the unpaid check, the promissory note that America owes to black people. And there was some Negro intellectual who wrote a book called A Debt. It's about reparations and all this stuff. And they think they're going to sue the United States government and get gazillions of dollars, you know. Notwithstanding that the dollar is worthless and America is totally bankrupt, if the Mexicans take over this country, they're not going to be too keen on the idea of sharing the wealth with the blacks anyway. So that's my observation. I think they're crazy. But I do think whites are waking up. So that's my observation.
And I know you do think that. Well, you can stay on the line till we end the show, Don. Just go ahead, you want to hang up. Okay. In the last 8 or 9 minutes we've got here, I do want to touch on Leo Frank because it's another anniversary. We missed this one, actually. This was August 17th. Was the 100-year anniversary of the lynching of Leo Frank. And Hadding and I did a international Jew show on the Leo Frank, the whole schmear, Mary Fagan deal earlier in the year, excuse me. But now this being the 100th anniversary of this whole thing, it's good to, you know, keep bringing it up because people need to remember about it. So we've got... one thing I've learned was that after Frank's lynching, approximately half of Georgia's 3,000 Jews left the state. And I thought, well, great. That's one way to get rid of them. And I figured out, let's see, if you can get rid of 3,000 with one lynching, let's see, you can get rid of 3 million if you have 1,000 lynchings. So maybe you should be thinking about that.
Yeah, it was similar with Operation Wetback when Eisenhower, however many his government gathered up and incarcerated and then shipped home, another 10 for every one of those deported themselves. There is truth to that, encouraging the others with that kind of a punishment. That's the whole theory behind the death penalty or any other penalty for crime, is to discourage people from doing it, to disincentivize it.
Right, so I think we should treat people badly who we don't want to have around, but of course the other people have this very opposite idea, oh, we need to treat these people well or we might lose them, you know.
Well, that's really kind of a slop bucket way to solve problems. You're talking about lynching, right? I mean, lynching is really not the ideal way to do things. Better to have a government that does the right thing on its own accord.
No, but do you think that the men of Georgia were right to go and get him out of prison and lynch him rather than allow him to be pardoned and remain, you know, alive?
You have conflicting standards of rightness there. It's like Antigone, where you have King Creon trying to maintain order and the state, and at the same time you have Antigone demanding justice on a personal level. It's a contradictory situation. In the long run, the best thing would have been, I suppose, if Frank had been allowed to live, there could have been endless discussion of how his kinsman, his racial kinsman, had gotten him off the hook. That could have been a cause going on for some years.
Well, it still can be, because they still did it, although the group of men didn't want to allow it, so they went and got him and lynched him. Well, I'll just say this that I was reading about on the September 2nd, 1915 issue of the Jeffersonian. They wrote that 2 weeks after the lynching, somebody, this guy Watson, who is, I don't know who he was in charge of some of this lynching.
Watson was a newspaper publisher.
Yeah. I think he was a publisher of the Jeffersonian. And, he said, here's what was said. The Ku Klux Klan, was put out a warning and said, we will meet Leo Frank League with the Gentile League if they provoke us much further. And this Watson said, another Ku Klux Klan may be organized to restore home rule. So they were wanting to restore their home rule and get rid of the influence of the Jews, who were already there in Georgia, you know, having a lot of influence. And I don't see anything wrong with that. When they put it that way, that was an effort to restore home rule. And so was the whole lynching, was to restore home rule, because this mayor
governor? It was the governor.
Yeah, the governor, I mean. I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm talking away here and not knowing. It was the governor who did that, and he didn't do that in the interest of the people of Georgia, but he got instructions from outside. So, you know, all in all, whether it looks crude and from people who aren't in on what's really going on, it was their effort to take control of their own processes, which the Jews were trying to take, had taken away from them. And we know that they've done that up to this day. So he said, Watson said, the voice of the people is the voice of God. And then his circulation went way up. of his newspaper. And then 2 months, so 2 months after they had taken Frank from the prison, these members of this, what they, this group that call themselves the Knights of Mary Fagan, you know, they were the ones, that's what they call themselves, these men who did all this, burned a gigantic cross atop Stone Mountain. And, then Southerners saw a similarity between the Frank trial and the Birth of a Nation, which was, you know, the Birth of a Nation was a movie, but what did it stand for? What was it representing? I don't even know right
now.
The
common racial interests between white Northerners and white Southerners to form a new nation.
Okay.
That we had more in common with each other as white Americans than we did with the influx of immigrants that had flooded into the country in the previous 20 or 30 years. And were starting to, take over, or at least flex their muscles. The Jews and the Catholics, the Papists.
Okay, and so then says Watson used the case to build support for a rebirth and revival of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, you know, I thought they needed that. It has a terrible name, Ku Klux Klan, and I don't really like their costumes, and I don't mind some of the burning. The cross burning maybe wouldn't be such a bad idea if they didn't have, well, although it looks kind of violent, but if they didn't wear those costumes, but that seemed to be something that was okay at the time. I don't know. But anyway, they needed something. They needed, it was like a group of, it was home rule. It was like, well, this is our land and this is the way we want things to be and we're not going to be taken over. That was all they, the only thing they could come up with. So, they had, we've got 60 seconds now. So any comments about the Leo Frank trial and that whole lynching business?
I think it proves that government doesn't work the way it's advertised to. And that's the give and take that you see is that when you have a corrupt government, the people, when they're healthy, rise up and do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. Yeah. Go ahead, Hanny.
You know, lynching became a sort of cultural institution after the war between the states because of the freed slaves. And it's really kind of an unfortunate thing. Because it really doesn't make the South look good. It's better to do things in an orderly and legal manner. But unfortunately, the legal institutions just weren't able to cope with the situation.
Yeah, the corruption started at the top. That's what the people
okay,
were
reacting. So, yeah.
But it's also the fact that laws made for white people and punishments made for white people just are not adequate to keep Negroes in line.
Agreed.
Well, that's very true. Absolutely. Oh. That's a good way to end. So, we thank you. This was fun tonight, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for staying with us and listening. And we'll see you in 3 months as our proof, our little proof here. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.